RAC's Post-Op Podcast is brought to you with the compliments of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons and leading financial services organisation, the Bongiorno National Network, the preferred choice for medical professionals across Australia. Emergency departments are thought to be the last bastion of equality, with prejudices expected to be left at the front door. In a lot of respects, that's true. However, studies in the United States have clearly shown socioeconomic and racial disparities in the treatment of trauma patients. That's according to American trauma surgeon Dr. Adil Heder, who has pioneered the work on racial trauma care. Dr. Heder is the Kessler Director for the Center of Surgery and Public Health at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health, and is the Associate Chair for Research at Brigham Surgery. Dr. Heder will deliver a keynote lecture at next month's annual scientific congress in Sydney titled Disparities in Trauma, Why is it Important and What Can We Do About It? First, he takes us back 10 years to an investigation he conducted into data from 400,000 significantly injured people in the United States. Some of the findings are quite stark, as he tells Heather Dawson on the phone from his American office in Boston.
If you happen to be black, you are 20% more likely to die compared to a similarly injured white person. And if you happen to be a Hispanic minority, you had about a 50% increased odds of death. We also found that not having insurance was a significantly additive factor, in that if you happen to be white and you didn't have insurance, and I compared you to a similarly injured person who had insurance, the person who didn't have insurance was 55% more likely to die. And if you happen to be a minority and didn't have insurance, you were like 80% more likely to die after a significant injury. And, you know, this was like the first paper that kind of showed these disparities in trauma care. And then after that, many different authors have found similar results. And most of them have concluded that just, even if you have insurance, just the difference between black and white, 20% increased odds of death. And that's just, frankly, unacceptable. We need to figure out a way for that to not happen.
Were you shocked by the results of that research that you did?
Well, you know, most people before we ever found this would not have expected trauma to have disparities in outcomes. My boss at the time, who remains my close friend and mentor, you know, he gave me this whole story about why that shouldn't happen. Because just a few years before I started working with him on this project, he was the surgeon at Johns Hopkins, where we were doing this, and the president of the country, at that time it was George Bush, was there visiting to give a lecture. And you know, the Secret Service and other people come through whenever the president travels, and they meet with the folks who would potentially have to take care of the president if something bad happened. And, you know, everything was, of course, perfectly in order, that if something bad happened and somehow the president got shot or something, where the president would be brought in and so on. And as the president had just left, Dr. Cornwell's pager went off, and he thought for a slight second, oh my God, did this something happen? And no, it wasn't the president. As you all know, George W. Bush was never shot. It was a young man, happened to be black, from the community. And that guy got exactly the same care that was reserved for the president. So how is it that we end up with differences in outcomes?
Well, some surgeons and other medical professionals get quite upset about the suggestion that there are racial disparities in healthcare outcomes, don't they? Why is that?
You know, I think we have certainly moved past some of that. 10 years ago, or maybe now 11 years ago, when I first presented this kind of work at the American Association for Surgery or Trauma, people did get upset. In fact, I recall very vividly after I made the first presentation on this work, and that one was about actually regarding children. And we showed that a minority or black children had an increased odds of having a functional deficit after traumatic brain injury. So there was no difference in survival between little kids who had a head injury, but there was a difference in these little kids' ability to either go home or have appropriate rehab or their ability to walk and talk and feed themselves. And we found that minority patients were much worse off as far as functional outcomes went. And as I finished presenting, somebody got up from the back of the audience and basically started screaming profanity. And this was at the most prestigious national meeting in the United States for trauma. And basically this person was like, you know, how dare you call into question that we have disparities? And the person even wrote a letter to the editor. But now, years later, I think the discussion has changed. The discussion has changed because many investigators have found the same disparities, and people have come to understand that, you know, this is true. You know, the United States is a large, vast country, and there are differences in quality of care, and there are differences in what care people receive. And our goal is to not refute the data and say, you know, that's not there, and put our heads in the sand and say, well, we just don't believe it. But our goal really needs to be that we need to do something about it. And I'll just give you an example. From that time when I presented that data to now 7-8 years ago when I presented at another very prestigious forum, there was the president of that association and a line of other major leaders all endorsing the data, all saying we need to come up with a solution for this.
So what kind of solutions are there? Is it just continuing to remind people about the research and so that doctors in trauma departments are much more conscious about potential bias in their minds?
Well, I think it really is, you know, multiple things. First is that we're still trying to understand the mechanisms that lead to disparities and differences in trauma care. And just broadly looking at them, there are many different mechanisms at play, but the two that I might mention right now are one is has to do with like a systematic issue and one is a provider issue. And what's the systematic issue? The systematic issue is that, and we did some research on this and found that there's definitely a difference in quality of care, that if you plot all the hospitals in the United States and look at their outcomes after injury, like if a person comes in and they get injured and they get, then, you know, how many people survive and how many people should have survived based on the injuries that they have. You can then plot a graph showing which trauma center is better and which is the best and which is the worst and so on. And it turns out that if you look at the trauma centers that are the worst performing, most of those trauma centers also happen to be the trauma centers that are providing most of the care to the minority patients. And not just minority patients, but minority patients who also happen to be uninsured, or even white patients who happen to be uninsured. So you can see these safety net trauma centers in many instances are understaffed, under-resourced, and no surprise that they end up having worse quality of care. And yes, they end up providing a lot of care for minority patients. And so what can we do? We can actually support those trauma centers instead of penalizing these trauma centers and say, oh, they're not doing a good job, we need to shut them down. Well, you can't just shut them down. Like in the south side of Chicago, for example, there's only one or two trauma centers. Not that they're bad ones. I'm not calling them out. I'm just saying if you shut them down, then what's going to happen? And so instead of shutting them down, we need to actually support them and make sure that they get the best quality of care and that especially these safety net trauma centers, the care can be improved.
Can you say anything about what's happening in other countries apart from the US? I mean, obviously, you're talking to us in Australia, New Zealand, for example. Are there similarities? Do you know?
Well, you know, Australia is also a very large and diverse country, and it is beautiful to see in my couple of visits to Australia, even over the past 10 years, the increasing diversity of your beautiful country. And that's a great thing. You know, there are all these opportunities for people to come work in Australia, become Australians, and then contribute to society and make society even better. I mean, it's the American model almost. And from what I understand, people who immigrate there are usually highly skilled and so on. And so what would be great is if other countries can learn from the American experience and, you know, not have to go through the same transitions, perhaps. I have seen and have heard of a lot of data regarding indigenous populations and the disparities that occur with them. I'm also seeing some emerging data, especially in the dermatologic literature, where there are differences in outcomes based in ethnicity in some areas. And this is not something unique to your country, but many countries in the world have begun seeing this. And so I think there's a lot to learn from this. And one thing to think about is the relationship between the provider and the patient. In the United States, there has been this recent trend of cultural competency, where people are expected to become competent in another person's culture. Somebody who doesn't look like you, you need to become competent in their culture so that you could potentially provide them great care. But the issue is that, competency, as you know, suggests that it's some sort of skill that you can acquire and master. But how can you acquire somebody else's culture just by reading about it, unless you're like truly living and breathing it? And if there are 60 different cultures that you need to provide care for, how are you going to know everyone? In fact, what the fear I have with cultural competency is that sometimes you begin to stereotype people. Everybody who looks a certain way is going to act a certain way. And that's probably even worse. And so what we've worked on is developing this concept of cultural dexterity, where we are providing surgeons with certain specific tools so that they may understand people better and use their dexterity to provide truly patient-centered care and meet patients where they are. We did some qualitative research where we went and interviewed patients. These are kind of more freehand interviews. We go and ask them all sorts of things and let them give us information. And we interviewed residents in the same way and surgeons. And we kind of figured out through those interviews and grounded theory and qualitative analysis, what are the important themes that emerge suggesting that surgeons could do a better job in taking care of patients and discussing conditions with patients. And through that, we were able to identify four things that are now part of this cultural dexterity training curriculum that we built, and we call it the PACTS curriculum, P-A-C-T-S, and like PACTS, and it's a provider awareness and cultural dexterity for training of surgeons curriculum, and it focuses on four things. It focuses on, as you could imagine, working with patients who have limited English proficiency. You know, there is a real skill in how you work with an interpreter to help provide care to a patient who is not proficient in English. So that's one. The second is, how do you manage pain? You know, pain is such an important part of what we do in surgery, pain management. And, you know, different cultures have different experiences, different people have different experiences. And how do you manage pain in a way that makes sense for the patient? We also, by the way, have huge disparities, at least in the United States, in management of pain. For example, you could have a person with a broken leg. The person happens to be an African-American male, much less likely to get narcotics versus a similar white person. So there's certainly room for improvement in managing pain, and that's one thing we talk about. The third is how to obtain an informed consent. And this is a very, as you can imagine, a very important field to look at because there's a significant variety of how people obtain informed consent. And there are certainly some good practices and certainly some terrible practices. And some of those terrible practices, like not really telling the person what to expect, may make it easier to get them to sign on a piece of paper. And of course, that's a terrible thing. But how do you do it with a person who may be coming from a different culture and have different expectations than you may have or the surgeon may have? So that's something that we certainly talk about. And then the fourth is about what you initially were mentioning, which is bias. And what are unconscious biases and how we can do certain things to keep ourselves in check to make sure that those are not operating when we are taking care of a patient.
Could you tell us a bit more about any unconscious bias that you discovered in your initial research?
So we were very concerned about this issue of unconscious bias, bias that you don't know that you even have, and it kind of manifests and impacts how you clinically take care of a patient. There is good data from the medical world where, you know, how you interact with a patient may be impacted by your unconscious preferences. And we did four different studies looking at the association between unconscious bias on medical students and how they would assess patients. And in fact, we didn't find anything there. We then said, okay, well, maybe the medical students are, you know, they come in and they're all want to do the best for these patients, so maybe they didn't have a difference. Let's look at surgical residents. We still didn't find a difference in how people, even if they had unconscious biases, and we have a way to measure unconscious bias using the implicit association test. So we measured unconscious bias amongst these surgical residents and then saw if they would treat people differently, and turns out they didn't. And then we did that with nurses. We said, well, maybe let's ask to find out if it works with the nurses, and we didn't find it there. And then we did it with fully qualified surgeons, and we didn't find it there. And each group had like 200 or so study subjects. So we did this for like 1,000 people on these four different groups, and we didn't find it in trauma. Now, this was different than what was happening in the medical world. And just to make a long story short, what we think is that unconscious bias may not rear its ugly head in the emergent care of patients, where especially there's a lot of protocolized care of what you have to do, especially in large level one trauma centers. But where it probably does interact more, and this is why you can see it more in the medical literature, is when you have to like really develop a relationship with a patient and work with them to provide better care. that's when you could, like, for example, you're trying to figure out how to manage somebody's blood pressure, and you could just make some unconscious assumptions about somebody and just give them one treatment versus the other treatment. I think that's where it may make a difference. But again, this was the first set of studies. I think there's still a lot more work that needs to be done to truly understand the impact of unconscious bias on acute care.
Well, Dr. Haider, obviously progress has been made since you started your research all those years ago. How optimistic are you in, say, the next 7 or 8 years that the U.S. will achieve greater equality in healthcare outcomes?
No, I must say I am very, very hopeful. And this might sound like an advertisement for the United States, but I must say, you know, we're not a perfect country, but we've made a lot of progress. And the reason why we're making progress, I think, is because we are open to discussing it. If we can discuss this, if we can talk about this, we can find why this happens, and we can come up with innovative solutions and get rid of it. And I am so fortunate that it's not just me. I'm a very small cog in this large wheel of work that is being done. There are countless investigators across the United States who are doing this work. We, a couple of years ago, had a summit with the National Institutes of Health and the American College of Surgeons, which is providing great leadership in this realm. And we brought together people from across the country and came up with a research agenda that was then published in JAMA Surgery. And that gives guidance to investigators across the country on programs that they can implement and research studies they can do to mitigate disparities. And a year after that was published, the National Institutes of Health really came through and put in major research dollars so that people could study the problem and fix the problem. So I am very optimistic because we have this leadership from the American College of Surgeons. We have support from national organizations like the NIH to understand the problem and make a difference. And most importantly, I got to say, it is the younger generation, the newer crop of surgeons. They want to make a difference. They want to have an impact. And I can't tell you how joyful it is to work with our younger colleagues, dozens of them, who are on a daily basis working on programs to make a difference.
Dr. Ardil Haider. RAC's Post-Op Podcast is brought to you with the compliments of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons and leading financial services organisation, the Bongiorno National Network, the preferred choice for medical professionals across Australia. You can reach the Bongiorno National Network on +613 9863 3111.